It's another edition of On Your Money. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. We're going to devote the entire hour to answering your personal finance questions. And when I say we, I mean Kevin McKinley. Saving for retirement, refinancing your home, buying a car, it's all food for thought on Your Money. Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and management member of McKinley Money, LLC, joins us. And let's get this thing started, Kevin. It's a special edition of On Your Money as we devote the entire hour to answering your questions. You can call 800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And Kevin, how are you doing today?
I am well, John, and you?
I am awake. It's as far
well,
as good.
It's nice to finally have a stronger male presence on this show for once.
Okay, I'm totally not going there. I am totally not going there. I think I'll just dive into the program. So let's get started with a question from Lisa in La Crosse. Here's what Lisa writes to us. I have been a longtime listener to your program, and so when my sister, who is disabled and living on a limited budget, called me yesterday in tears because she may be facing home foreclosure due to not having the balance of her upcoming property taxes. The only hope I had to offer her was to ask you if you would know of any state or federally funded grants available, one time only, to aid persons facing this situation. I promised I would contact you. You are a fine person, well in tune with sound financial advice. Thank you for your consideration in offering any help. So let's talk about her situation. Should she should start with the people who are asking for the property tax money?
Yes, she should. How could we turn this question down? Good one to lead with. Lots of false praise in there. Her sister should actually contact the people to whom she owes the property taxes, because several local municipalities, communities, towns, whatever, have programs in place for people who, for whatever reason, cannot pay their property taxes. Sometimes it's a one-time abatement. Other times it's something where they'll reduce the dollar amount. And finally, there are some cases where people, especially seniors, can do some kind of volunteer work within the community and apply some of that work towards a reduction in their property taxes. So her sister should definitely contact them and say, look, I can't pay these taxes. What can I do to help offset what I owe you?
And what if she can't find any local help?
Then she should go right to the federal level and focus more on just affording the cost of an upkeep of keeping the home. MakingHomeAffordable.gov. MakingHomeAffordable.gov is the website, the government website, that has lots of different programs on there where she can look for different areas that she can get help from. And it's often going to be with HUD, Housing and Urban Development, who has licensed counselors in the area that who can talk with her and just say, okay, explain your situation to us, and then we'll tell you what we know about how you can be helped. And if she does have a mortgage on the home that she's having a difficult time affording, she may want to just go right to the lender and discuss the situation and say, what programs are in place? How can you help me stay in this home and still hold up my end of the obligation?
Okay, so what if she does all of this and still can't resolve this issue? What should she do?
Well, if she goes all the way through that, there's really not much more she can do other than to try to sell the home herself first, which is much more preferable than going to the foreclosure process. The foreclosure process is very difficult and very time-consuming, and it's very difficult to sell a home anyway in some localities, but especially under the foreclosure process. And she should keep in mind that sometimes people who have all the resources and wherewithal and means can still buy a big house and pay for it in cash, but they still choose to rent. And renting is not the end of the world. Many people do it, and for some people it's the right situation. And if she can and finally has to sell the house and can find a place to rent, it may be better off for her as well.
She might explore some ways to acquire more income.
That's right. She can also look if she wants to bring in a renter or help offset it or whatever. If there's any way she can use what she does have to increase her income, that could help as well.
Okay. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. Is the number to call to ask your financial questions this hour on Your Money, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. That's onyourmoney, all one word, at wpr.org. Here's a question from Dave, who says, I'm 59 years old and have a $113,000 mortgage with a $621 monthly payment. If I retire at 62, my pre-tax income, including Social Security, will be about $3,800. Should I continue to plow money into my mortgage or just accept the fact that I have a mortgage for life and continue to save more cash?
Well, it's our old axiom here at On Your Money is that despite opinions to the contrary and sentiments held by many well-meaning people, it's safer to have the mortgage and the money than to have no mortgage but no money. And especially if interest rates rise in the future and Dave has a need for cash for an emergency or for something fun he wants to purchase, he'll be very happy that he still has the money and this probably very low interest rate mortgage. And if not, he can always pay it off in the future. Generally, mortgages have absolutely no prepayment penalty whatsoever. But if he does pay it off now and then needs that money at some point in the future, he may not even be able to get the mortgage, and especially at the historically low current interest rates. And if he is retired, it's going to be even more difficult for him to get that mortgage back in the future.
Well, and Kevin, with his if his monthly payment is $621, it's pretty hard to imagine what he could rent for that.
He's not talking about renting, I think. I think he's talking about just paying off the mortgage and staying in the home.
Well, I know, but I mean, his monthly expense for home ownership is I mean, you have to live somewhere, and it's going to cost you something, and it sounds like he's got a pretty good deal.
Yes, he does.
So let's assume he's going to pay it off as soon as possible. What would you suggest?
Well, a couple things. He should not cash money out of a retirement account, especially a pre-tax one like an IRA or a 401k or a 403b, in a lump sum just to pay off the mortgage, because he will probably get hit with a huge tax bill by doing that. He could lose probably 20 to 30% of that amount or more to income taxes, depending on what bracket he's already going to be in. Instead, he should pull money from his savings until he can pay it off, or hopefully not draw down his entire non-tax deferred savings. Or he should just pull enough out of his pre-tax accounts every single year, like his IRAs and 403Bs and 401Ks, pull enough out to just stay in the 15% federal income tax bracket. And that's delineated on line 43 of the 1040. And in 2013, that figure is about $36,000 for single filers and about $72,000 for married couples filing jointly. So if he wants to pay it off sooner than he has to and needs to pull it out of retirement accounts, just pull it out enough out to stay below the top of the 15% federal tax bracket, because otherwise the money is going to be taxed at 25% at the federal level.
Well, and what if he needs that money at some point in the future?
It's probably best to keep a home equity line of credit just so he can get at that equity in the future. The lender to whom he already owes this money on the mortgage be more than happy to establish a home equity line of credit for him, assuming his credit is good. And then what he can do is tap that home equity line of credit once it's established. And he should probably have it set up for as much as the lender will allow. Once he applies for it, it's generally difficult and rare for the lender to take it away, and he only has to pay interest on what part of the line of the credit he uses, meaning if he has a $50,000 line of credit but only draws $10,000 from it, he only has to pay interest on the $10,000 amount, and typically it's interest-only payments for the first few years that he draws from that. And then after a while, the lender might say, you know what, you've had this out for a while. If you can't pay it back, we'll just convert this to a fixed home equity loan with a set payment schedule over a period of time.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we've got some callers who want to ask questions, Kevin. So let's take one of them. We'll start with Mary in Wauwatosa. Mary, thanks for joining us on Your Money today.
Thank you very much. Hello, Kevin. I have a two-part question. Number one is that we are with a fee-for-service financial advisor. We've been with him for a number of years, and I am in the process of trying to evaluate his performance for us. And I'm wondering if you can give me any hints about how to go about doing that, because there have been numerous transactions over those years. And then the second part of the question is, he tends to favor funds with actively managed funds with fees anywhere from 1.1 to 1.4% versus index funds, for example, Vanguard with low expense ratios. Is there a website that I can go to that would give me a way to compare in real time the performance of actively managed funds versus an index fund? And if I can, I'll take your answer off the air so I can write down what you say.
Or you can just listen to the rebroadcast, which apparently is on, I think, 8 times each week, Mary. And on WPR.org, it's archived as well if I say something you possibly need to hear again. But it's a good question. And from the details you've related, Mary, it sounds like he's on a commission basis. And there's nothing inherently wrong with paying a financial advisor commissions for their services. What is wrong is when you think that the financial advisor is taking activities or doing things based solely to earn the commissions on the transaction. Because you always wonder and say, is he or she recommending this because it's the right thing to do, or because they think it's the right thing to do, or is it because they just want to make some money by the commission? And that's why I want to say everybody, there's still a lot of good commission-based financial advisors out there, but more advisors than ever are moving to a fee-based structure because clients are generally more comfortable paying a set percentage per year that usually ranges from 0.5% up to 1.5% for the management and the advice, et cetera. In terms of tracking the performance, probably Morningstar.com is one of the better ones out there, but you can also go, you can actually type a mutual fund symbol into Google, and Google has a finance page that will relate all the performance, give you some comparison options as well. Generally, over time, the index funds to which you were referring are probably going to outperform most of the actively managed funds, and it's not because they're better. It's generally because they're just less expensive. There's less of a drag on it. And especially when stock prices and a lot of other asset prices are near all-time highs, we're likely to get lower return in the future. And therefore, if your return is being eaten up by fees that aren't providing any value to you, it's more likely you'll be dissatisfied with the performance. In terms of measuring the financial advisor's performance, you have to ask yourself a couple questions. First of all, what are your other options? Do you have another financial advisor or someone in mind? And if so, what does he or she do versus what he or she costs to work with? Second of all, can you do it yourself? And a lot of people can through using services like Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity or some of the TD Ameritrade is another one too. A lot of people can do that themselves. Some people just aren't comfortable with it. So like a lot of intangible services, the question is really, do you feel it's worth what you're paying? And second of all, do you know what you're paying? Are you aware of all the compensation? And once you add it up, do you feel like it's worth it to you? And the great news about it, Mary, is that your judgment on that is the correct one. If it's worth it to you, it's worth it. If it's not, it's not.
All right, Mary, thanks thanks for that call, and I hope you got the notes. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back in just a moment, and Kevin will answer more of your questions on Your Money. The phone number, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also reach us via email. The email address is onyourmoney, all one word, onyourmoney@WPR.org. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash.
It's On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. And of course, as always, On Your Money is hosted by Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Kevin, we have an email from Eileen who writes, I am thinking of converting some of my IRA to a Roth IRA. I've always heard you say that you should contribute to the IRA and then immediately convert to a Roth. Why immediately? What if the money has been in the traditional IRA for a few years before it's converted? As far as the taxes, I've read that all IRAs are looked at to figure the taxes on the conversion, and I don't understand this. I have one traditional and one Roth IRA. Well, lots to chew on there.
And I'm confused as well. Eileen, I have questions for you. I don't think I've ever said you should immediately contribute to an IRA and then convert it to a Roth IRA. You may want to convert it eventually at some point, but what you may want to do is contribute directly to a Roth IRA if it behooves you. And typically, you have to qualify. You have to have earned income on which to base the contribution. And then it also has to make sense. And the more money you make, the more taxes you pay. And the more taxes you pay, the more likely it is that if you can contribute to an IRA, you should use that instead of the Roth IRA, because you don't get any tax break on the Roth IRA. In terms of all IRAs being looked at to figure the taxes on the conversion, that part isn't true. Whatever you convert from an IRA to a Roth IRA, it is taxed as ordinary income, and it can be taxed very highly because it's piled on top of all the other taxable income you have. So you should generally only do it when you are going to have already be in a low income tax bracket, or you feel like in the future you will be in much higher income tax bracket, so it makes sense to pay it now by converting an IRA to a Roth IRA. And then once it's in the Roth IRA, not only do the distributions avoid taxes, but according to a current law, the distributions do not affect the taxation of your Social Security when you're retired. And there's no mandatory distribution at 70.5 on the Roth IRA like there is on an IRA. So it's a good idea to do it, but only if you feel like you're going to be able to do it when you're in a very low tax bracket.
Eileen, thanks. Thanks for that email. The email address, by the way, if you'd like to communicate with the program today, is onyourmoney, all one word, onyourmoney@wpr.org. Or you can call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. And speaking of call us, Marcia in Sussex has called us. Marcia, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much. First, I have to say, Kevin, that if I get up on a Tuesday morning and put my radio on at about 8:07 and you're not the guest, I get depressed. So that's my real praise for you.
Marcia, I feel the same way. If I'm not the guest, I get depressed too.
No, you're usually on vacation on the beach somewhere, so.
That's my wife.
Anyway, Kevin, my question is I recently changed the beneficiaries on my IRAs, my Roth and regular IRAs. And since we're in Wisconsin and my financial guy is in Florida, they sent me all the paperwork that my husband had to sign off and have notarized and all that kind of stuff. So what I'm wondering is, if I want to take money out of any of my accounts, I'm thinking of my Roth right now, do we have to go through the same procedure?
Generally, no. It depends on how the money is taken out. And sometimes different institutions have different forms for how they choose to do this. And quite frankly, it's for, you know, like a lot of annoying laws, it's for your protection. And it's so that he can't take money out and spend it. And typically, this really was in 2013, it's not as gender specific, but 30 or 40 years ago, when there were more stay-at-home wives and more working men, the proportion was different. It was protect women from men having control over the money, control over the accounts, taking it, and then leaving their wife and leaving her with no money and no job at the time. So I don't mind it from a legal standpoint. In terms of a procedural standpoint, it depends on the institution to a great degree. Are you taking the money out just on an ad hoc basis, or are you taking regular distributions from it? How are you going to get at it?
No, I just need some money, and that would be the place I would go first, is my Roth.
Okay. It's a good place to get it, and the reason being is that, as you hopefully know, contributions from Roth IRAs can be pulled out with no taxes or penalties at any time for any reason whatsoever. That's the contribution portion, and the good people at the IRS let us designate the first withdrawals as contributions until we've used that amount up. So I would recommend you go about that. Has the firm in question asked you also to sign off, to have him sign off on the distributions from the Roths?
I haven't progressed that far yet.
Okay, I check with them first and see what they say. But as all retirement accounts go, the Roth is the first one I would tap. So at least from that standpoint, that's the right way to go.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Marcia.
Yes, thanks for your call, Marcia. Here's an email from Ralph, who writes, "Let me start off with some false praise and thank you for your wonderful advice over the past years." Then he goes on to write, "Our financial advisor has approached us with a choice of changing from a commission-based account to a fee-based account. He says that this will give him more flexibility and diversity in managing our account. He said that it would cost us approximately $3,400 a year. I would appreciate your assessment of this change in managing our accounts."
See, John, we just referred to this 5 minutes ago, and it's happening already. I can't believe this. This is amazing how quickly our effect is.
Radio is a powerfully immediate media.
Even with two people like you and me.
Yeah, that's right. It's amazing.
Yeah, I actually believe in those claims. And if you like the financial advisor and you want to give him the benefit of the doubt, it's true. I started off in, 1988 as a financial advisor. So in 1994, I said, you know what, this fee-based arrangement seems like a better deal for the clients because it does give me more flexibility. And I was right. And over the last, 20, 25 years, many advisors and their clients are happy with this. The nice thing about the fee-based arrangement is that not only does it give him more flexibility, but Ralph, it gives you the option of terminating the relationship, and he loses, the financial advisor loses the future income stream from that. So there's a very strong and natural financial incentive for him to keep you happy, give you good service, because if you stop the relationship, he loses his revenue from it, whereas if he had just put you in straight commission funds and received an upfront commission, he might be the greatest guy in the world, he might be really helpful, but from a financial incentive, it's in his best interest for something for you to disappear from the face of the earth, because he will get paid no more money from you except you're expecting a lifetime of service from him. So I would go with it and see how it works, and it is correct. It does give him more flexibility, and it gives you more power over the relationship as well.
Ralph, thanks for that email. Let's take a phone call next from Min in Madison. Min, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Hi. I have a question. My wife and I, we both are at 40s, and we saved to the 403B and 457 about 55,000 per year. And we still have some money to save up because our gross income before tax is about 200,000. And we don't know, do we need a financial advisor? Because another thing is we refinance our house and we cash out about $50,000. So we have cash $50,000 in hand. And also we have one car we have to pay monthly like $400. And also, we have like mortgage payment, like $1,700 per month, including the property debt. So we still have some money we can invest or we can save. So we are thinking about buying another house as a second house and then rent it out, or maybe buying the gold or stock or something like that. So is there anything you want to give a comment or advice?
Min, thanks for the call. Kevin?
Congratulations. Do you have any things coming up? Like, do you have children with maybe going to college at some point in the future?
We don't have a kid. But my wife, she wants to retire a little bit early, like 55. So we want to prepare for that. We both have like $300,000 in our 401. Actually, is it a 403? Saving. That's all we have.
Sure. Okay. Well, you're on a great track, and I think that that's actually from the limited information I have from you, man, I think it's actually possible, if not probable, that you may be able to she may be able to retire at 55. If you said I'm going to do one thing with this money, I would actually have you probably look more towards the real estate rather than the gold or the stocks, in part because the real estate is much more work. It's also much more lucrative. And if you have the time and the energy, it can be a great way to slowly build up equity. But it does require either time and energy on your part or for you to basically hand over all of the first few years of any profits to a property management company who will do the work for you but might take 20-30% of the revenue from it. So I would look at that as well. And if you say, you know, we don't want the hassle, we just want to preserve this money, have it be here as long as we can, I'm guessing the retirement plans are invested in stocks. And so you may want to hedge those stocks a little bit, diversify by just putting it into straight CDs and those Series I savings bonds to which a previous caller has asked about, and we'll talk about those again. But those don't pay very much in interest, but they are very safe. And so if you need the money either for your own use in the future or you need it for an opportunity, like the stock market goes down or a nice piece of real estate comes up, you'll have the money there. And in the meantime, you can expect to earn maybe 1% to 2% a year on the very longer-term CDs and as well as some of the savings bonds.
And Min, I think, had also asked if he and his wife needed to engage the services of a financial planner. I'm guessing you would say yes.
They can. They sound like very typically what people like them get from a financial planner is either a second set of eyes saying yes or no, you are correct or you're wrong. Here's where you're missing. Sometimes people like them, they have the time and the energy and the interest to do it themselves, and they're just as happy doing it. But not everybody needs or even benefits from a financial planner. Sometimes we find lots of people who can do it themselves and really enjoy it. It's, you know, some people buy tomatoes at the supermarket and it's much more efficient way to get a tomato on your table, but other people really like growing them in their garden and doing the work themselves.
Okay, Min, good luck and thanks for calling. Here's a question we mentioned it in the intro to the program way back whenever that was. Anne has two children in college and needs to borrow money to pay for part of the expense. Should she take a home equity line of credit to pay the shortfall and have them pay her back, or get a Parent PLUS loan or a private loan? She says, any thoughts are greatly appreciated. I enjoy listening to your show on WPR.
That's the one, John, where they throw the false praise in right at the end, going, darn it, I forgot. I started
yeah,
the whole question.
I should have mentioned that at the front. Yeah, yeah.
Asterisk right there.
Yeah.
There's a proper order to borrowing money for education expenses, and typically it goes like this. You start with student loans. The unsubsidized ones should be second from the subsidized ones. Then go to Parent PLUS loans. Then go to private loans from a private lender, like a bank or credit union. And then go after the mortgage. Typically, people do open up a home equity line of credit and tap it that way.
And what's the reasoning behind that order?
There's a couple reasons. One is I like student loans in part because they typically offer the best interest rates, plus there's a chance for an income-based repayment plan. If the kid gets out of school and doesn't make enough money to pay off the loans, there's kind of an income-based deferment plan on the federal plans. The parent loans are nice because you can get money for education. You can borrow up to the cost of the kid's education less any aid, and you can still maintain the home equity if there is any there. Private loans are usually not as good of a deal, and they do require more of a strict credit background. And then finally, the home equity is something that can be used for anything. And so I'd rather have people use student loans and parent loans for education first, because there might be some other big financial need that comes up that they wish they would have had the home equity available.
But these loans should only be considered after savings are exhausted?
No, in fact, and again, this goes against the grain of what many financially responsible people think, but I would prefer people get all the loans they can as soon as possible. And if you have kids who are attending higher education institutions, you may want to consider getting a new 30-year fixed-rate mortgage for as much as the lender will allow, and then just parking the money and setting it aside. You get the best interest rates right now on the mortgages. And plus, that money may not be available in the future, and it may not be available at today's very low interest rates. If you get some cash out of it, especially from the home equity loan, line of credit, or the mortgage, you can use that for all different kinds of purposes along with education. Or if you take other loans out, you can use the cash to make payments on the loans to keep them current and kick the can down the road until the kid gets a job and grows up and becomes a real grown-up. But again, if you are going to get a mortgage, get a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, get it for as much as the lender will allow. Usually that's about 80% of the loan-to-value, and then don't invest the money. Just park it in a safe place for an emergency.
All right. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to ask your question of Kevin McKinley, our financial planner on Your Money. And you can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's take another phone call. This time it'll be Joe in Luck. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin, and the rest of you up there. All phrases up front. I had a question in regards to a Roth IRA. I know I can have one, and I can have a 401k, and that doesn't count against student aid for my children. But I was wondering if you can set up a minor account, and if that counts against their student aid, like their financial lending.
Yeah, I think we're going to handle a question regarding Roth IRAs for minors later in the show. In terms of financial aid, that's a great question. Generally, no. Retirement accounts, even if it's in the kid's name, do not preclude need-based financial aid, at least on the federal methodology level. There's usually two different ways schools calculate financial aid. It's the federal methodology and institutional methodology. Some schools do bring those into it, but again, it's typically, by definition, it's not going to be a lot of money. Therefore, it's not going to preclude them from getting a lot of need-based aid. Now, the neat thing about that is the Roth IRA, as we discussed, can actually be used to pay for college if there is a shortfall, because you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want. Just keep in mind that when you pull those contributions back out, there's no tax, there's no penalty, and then you can pay for school. But the next year when they file for financial aid, that might show up as income, which could artificially inflate the income and then artificially drop some of the need-based financial aid. But no, I think that's a very good idea. And again, if you can stay on for a few more minutes, Joe, we're going to speak more to that subject.
All right. Thanks so much for that call. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll have some more questions, including we will down the road here talk about opening a Roth IRA for your children with Kevin McKinley, our financial planner. It's On Your Money. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Greenback paper bill.
It's On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. And, of course, with me is Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and management member of McKinley Money, LLC. We're here. Well, Kevin's here to answer your questions. I'm just in charge of traffic control. We did mention this. You mentioned this before the break. Here's a question about the Roth IRA situation. Warren wants to open a Roth IRA for his young daughter, and Pamela wants to open one for a grandchild, but they can't provide find a provider who will do it.
Well, their efforts, difficult though they may be, are going to be well worth it for a teenager who has a job. You can use the earnings as the basis for contribution to a Roth IRA. You can try to convince the kid to put her earnings into the account, but if you can't, you can put money into that account for her. Now, it is a gift, and it's her money, but you don't necessarily have to use the actual dollars he or she has earned. The contribution limit is the lesser of her earnings or the contribution limit, which is $5,500 for 2013. But let's just say you get $1,000 into a Roth IRA for a 16-year-old right now, and let's say that money has a hypothetical return of 6% per year. By the time she is in her 60s, it could be worth 20 times that amount. And best of all, she can pull it out tax-free.
But as you say, it apparently isn't an easy task.
No, and it's because you're opening an account for someone who is a minor, and the age that defines that term, it depends on the state, it runs from 18 to 24. You need to open a custodial Roth IRA, and not all providers do it, in part because there's usually not a lot of money in it for them, and there's not a lot of money in the accounts either. But Schwab, E-Trade, Wells Fargo are a few of the institutions who will do that. Vanguard has done it in the past, and I think they still do it now as well. Now, the problem with it is it shouldn't be an issue for Warren to go to an institution as the ones we mentioned, but Pamela may still not be able to because generally the legal description and definition on these accounts requires that a parent or guardian be the custodian of the account and be the one actually setting up the account for the minor.
So is there any way around that requirement?
Well, Pamela can actually fund the account. She can have the parents open the account and be in charge of it, and then Pamela can write a check even directly to the parents or to the Roth IRA sponsor for the dollar amount. And she only has to contribute it by April 15th of the year following the year in which she's making it. So let's say she has a grandchild who's working right now. Pamela can technically open and fund the account on April 15th of next year. She should do it sooner rather than later, obviously, but she can wait until, it's got to be 9 months from now, that she can put that money aside into that account.
All right. Well, Warren and Pamela, good luck to you. Let's take another call here, and this time it'll be Glenn in Neillsville. Glenn, thanks for joining us.
Yes. It's a pretty easy question. We have a son who's got about $15,000 in student debt. He's paying almost 7% interest on it. He got it, I think, probably 4 or 5 years ago. He's paying $300 a month. My wife and I are retired, but we could easily lend him $15,000 at the about 1.15% interest we're getting in savings right now. Just want to make sure that it's okay, that it makes sense. The only problem is, obviously, we have no ability to make sure he pays it back in the end, although we trust him. So, easy question.
Yeah, it is. On a logistic standpoint, it can be. You just have to make sure a couple things are true to make it as clean as possible. And one thing I would do is document the loan. And that's helpful both for IRS purposes in the future, because technically if you give them money, you'll be exceeding the gift amount. Not a big deal, but the amount that you can give to another person every single year technically is $14,000 per person without a gift tax issue arising. So you want to document that. Now, you obviously want to consider having a lawyer and a CPA look at the arrangement, but if you want to do the documents yourself, you can go to a place called loanback.com, LOANBACK, loanback.com, and for about, I think it's about $25 or $30, you can punch in the terms of the loan, and it'll spit back a contract with not only the agreements and the language you need for it, but also the terms of the payment to make sure, as your son sends you back the checks, hopefully, you can check off in the contract each one of those checks, document that it came in, and then if he needs to miss a payment or needs to double up or skip a couple, you can know exactly where you're at on that. And then it also requires him to sign that, so he's got some more skin in the game as well. But I think it's a very good idea, and especially for the dollar amounts that you're talking about, it's nice to eliminate the middle person and just collect a little bit of interest from him, and then he can lower what his payments are as well, and probably get a better, more amenable arrangement in terms of missing the payments if something should come up in the future.
All right.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
I just think people with more skin in the game are his three siblings than with us. So.
Yeah, he's setting a precedent here, right?
Right, right.
Okay. Glenn, good luck with that. Thanks for calling. Here's an email from Catherine. Catherine writes, I am a 29-year-old single professional childless woman. I currently contribute the max to my 403B each year, and since I was 24, an additional $1,500 a year to a Roth IRA. If I continue at this rate until my potential retirement at age 70, am I sitting strong for retirement or setting myself up for a very frugal one? Help me, Kevin, get this stress out of my heart.
Catherine, not only should you not be stressed out about your situation, but if you are single and looking, the exact text of your email should be your profile on Match.com or something, because you to be commended for what you've accomplished so far, at least from a financial basis. So good for you. I love it. I love what you're doing. I think it's Here's why I love this. It's not so much how much you're saving, it's how little you're spending. You are redirecting several thousand dollars a year to your retirement accounts that you probably won't need but won't really be able to get at for 30 years. And by living on less than what you're actually making, you're not only cutting your tax bill significantly, but you're also establishing the number one factor that I look at when people ask me, how am I doing financially? I don't look at what you have. I don't look at what you make. I look at what you're spending. And the less that you spend, the more likely you will be able to retire on your terms and be very comfortable. And I'm guessing between this, what you're doing with the Roth IRA and the 403B, I'm guessing you're probably getting about $15,000 a year or more set aside. And if you are, and you do that over 20 to 25 years, you get a little growth to it, you're looking at probably $500,000. And then once you put that on top of your Social Security payments, and if you're fortunate enough to have a pension payment, you might find yourself, Catherine, like a lot of people I've seen, actually make more money retired than they did working.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck, Catherine, and I hope that we were able to relieve some of your stress. Let's take another call. Larry in Middleton will be next. Larry, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. I'm comparing a FDIC insured money market account with FDIC insured certificate of deposit. My understanding is that in either type of account, the insurance would pay a claim for the entire amount deposited plus accrued interest. Is that correct?
It can be, and especially if the problem is with the individual institution and it's not a systemic financial problem. There's only so much money in the FDIC insurance account insurance fund, and it's obviously in a very the powers that be have a very strong interest in not letting any bank go under, but it's not an unlimited reserve. Either one will give you the payback that you expect, if, again, as long as it's just a problem with one institution, not a bunch of them. I've seen some things in the 2008-2009 financial crisis that kind of shook my belief in this insurance, but it's still better than just about anything else out there. A couple things I would do to help mitigate it. One is even if you don't have the $250,000 amount that is the limit of the insurance, I would try to spread it out with a couple different institutions if you can. And if you want to get some idea of how strong those institutions are, you can go to Bankrate, and they have a thing called the Safe and Sound, which gives their opinion on the financial institution stability. It's not perfect, but it's better than trying to, you know, go to the institution yourself and search through it. And we'll have a link up to that at onyourmoney.com. Third thing I would do is, because we're in such a low interest rate environment, you might be better off just using some treasury bills as well, because those are even, you know exactly where that money is, you know when it's going to come due, so, and the yields are so low on money markets and short-term CDs that getting a short-term treasury bill isn't going to cost you a lot, but it might be one added, kind of a belt and suspenders level of safety for you.
All right, Larry, good luck with your decision. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, the number to call to ask your question of our financial planner, Kevin McKinley. And you can also send an email. The address is onyourmoney, onyourmoney is all one word, onyourmoney@WPR.org. Let's talk next with Robert in Onalaska. Robert, thanks for joining us. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
Yeah, Robert, go ahead. You're on.
I thank you for taking my call. I'm 80 years old, retired since 1995. When I was working, the company had a stock option plan for the employees. And I bought some stocks through that plan with him. And I've held them all these years. At the time, it was $28 a share when we bought them. Now, I called the check, Wells Fargo Bank, to check on selling them. And the prices, what they're selling for now is $45, so that's what I'll be getting per share when they sell them now in a day or two. And I'm wondering on that, what taxes I probably will have to pay on that.
Okay, Robert, thanks for the question.
Yeah, thanks. I don't think you have to pay very much, if anything. In fact, it'll be a long-term capital gain, likely, and people in the 15% or lower federal income tax bracket, which most retired people are, the majority of retired people anyway are in that bracket, they pay 0% on long-term capital gains in terms of a tax rate. And so at the most you probably pay is maybe a total of about 20% or so of the gain, the $20 difference between the two, and that's not much. That's $4 of the share price. But again, in your lower tax bracket, Robert, if indeed you're there, I don't think you'll pay much at all in the way of it. And they just extended that loss, so it's probably with the price of the stock being up and the laws being what they are, you could have picked a lot worse times to sell than 2013.
Robert, thanks for the question. Let's take a call next from Jim in Menasha. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Kevin.
Go ahead.
Hi, Jim.
Well, I'm 59. I basically started over financially when I was 56 due to a series of events. Had to file bankruptcy. My question is, I did land a job. I'm making below national average, but I'm happy. I've been putting in approximately 43% into the 403B. My question is, I'm hoping to make it to 62, but some medical issues came up. And I heard another financial advisor say, if you've got less than 5 years, as far as investing, you should just save and not invest in case the market went down. That's basically my worry, is if I do end up not being able to work, or I do make it to 62 and that 403B goes down. Any advice?
Yeah, congratulations on starting over and contributing as much as you are, and most importantly, saying you're happy. There are a lot of people with a lot more money than you who can't make that statement, so good for you. I appreciate your attitude, Jim. I agree with that other financial advisor. I mean, I don't normally endorse listening to anybody else other than this show for financial advice. But in this case, I agree with him. I think that if you have a narrow or a shorter window of time to invest, and especially in this day and age, you should be cautious about putting too much of your money at risk, because we could very easily have a 30 to 40% drop again, like we have had in the past and definitely will have in the future. So I would rather have you invest as much as you are from the tax standpoint, getting that immediate tax break, but stick towards the more conservative options. And you probably have a plan provider or a person in HR at your employer who will be able to tell you which one of those options are if you can't. But generally, that means more cash, maybe a stable value account, some bonds, maybe a little bit of stocks as well. That should help mitigate some of the loss. But I'd much rather have you err on the side of caution for this short period of time, Jim. So good for you.
Jim, good luck. Here's a quick email from Carrie who says, Kevin, I love your program. It helps a lot that I generally agree with you. One of the ways I've taken your sage advice was to take most of my tax refund in the form of I-bonds. This is when the only way you could get them was online. Therefore, I was really surprised to get a fat envelope from the government filled with paper certificates. What the heck do I do with these? I don't like having them around, in danger of getting lost or taken. Can I switch them to electronic form?
That's a weird situation, but you can get the paper bond in the form of a tax refund, and it's a good way to exceed the normal $10,000 limit of I-bonds. You can put them back into your account with treasurydirect.gov and have them receipted in electronically, or keep them in a safe deposit box with all your baubles and valuables. And if they were lost or stolen, they're not bearer bonds. Someone can't just take them to the bank and cash them in. You have a specific account number and ID number on those where you can get them replaced. It's a small fee to do so, about, I think, 50 or 75 bucks or something. But don't worry about them getting lost or taken. But if you do, send them back to treasurydirect.gov and tell them to put them in your account electronically.
Very quickly, Kevin, what's the website of the week?
Debtadvice.org, one we've mentioned before, but they have a couple great things for people who are concerned about the amount of debt they have or a loved one has. Debtadvice.org. You can even find an accredited counselor there, and we'll have that link it up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin will be off next week. He'll be back on August 20th. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network. of Wisconsin Public Radio.